seachtain an Indo-Ascaliger.
Táim I mon iarachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chorp, agus súlagam amach an seo gur féidir é a chur in uaig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara i gcuirna meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gnám go raibh orthcháir in reachtam. Iadach sé tarann go raibh an orthcháir san i lis dúthail agus go mina fnacht gáir a chlig sár ducha sin éair. Ná ní bhíon ann tar d'oraach sé sin. Vin Marav.
Shachtan. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
Listen and follow the Left Wing Rugby podcast with me, Will Slattery, and Luke Fitzgerald.
So he goes back a better player from this experience, and he'll have a few extra quid in his pocket, so, and possibly a medal in his pocket. It's a great move for him. It's good for Leinster in some ways, but in other ways, and I think I'm more leaning this way, I don't like it for Leinster either. I think the homegrown talent that they have, I really feel like they might curtail some of these things.
Every week on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Just a quick heads up, the episode you're about to hear covers some pretty heavy content, including descriptions of violence towards children. With that in mind, we'd recommend your discretion when listening, especially around our younger audience. Thanks.
On July 29th, 2013, Kathleen Chadha's husband Sanjeev brutally murdered their two sons, Owen and Rory. They were just 10 and 5 years old. Now she's written their story and she joins me today.
They weren't being left alone in the morgue, that there was somebody with them all the time, and that they were leaving the lights on. So that was... You know, that was important to me at the time, still is. And I suppose that's where I talk about the love that the boys have inspired.
Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today. Your new book, Everything, is... As I was saying to you in an earlier, it reads like a tribute to your two beautiful boys, Owen and Rory. And there's also that sense of you being able to offload a little bit, a kind of therapy in the writing. Is that fair to say?
It is. I mean, I always say I live with this all the time. It's in my head all the time. So to be able to put it together in one place. And it's not that I necessarily need to go back and read it to know what happened, but it's almost a reassurance if in a way. But even the writing of it in the first place was you do relive things. It was triggering in a way, but exactly as you said, there's a therapy in that, and I suppose in the last 10 years, I've been one to try and confront sort of the emotions around what happened. I don't want to hide away from them because I don't think that does me any good. So I tend to confront the emotions.
Can we go back 10 years then, yeah. Kathleen, to the 29th of July, 2013. Owen is 10 years of age, little Rory, 5 years of age. They are taken out for a game of bowling with their father, Sanjeev, who you met while you were working in Saudi Arabia. The pair of you happily settled in Carlow at the time of 2013. What happens?
So, I suppose about 10 days previously, we'd found out that Sanj had been embezzling money from the local community centre. That was very shocking to me at the time. I would have considered him very honest. It never, ever would have occurred to me that he would do something like this. So, obviously, things were quite tense between us at that time.
You say community funds. How did you find out about that? Or how was he doing this?
So he, a number of months previously, had gone to the AGM and had either been elected or put himself forward to be the treasurer of the on the committee for the community centre. So we have a really, really strong, thriving local community centre. It's one, there's a bar in it, and they do other events. So, you know, it was, I suppose, somewhat money generating. So there was a significant amount of money in the funds there. He'd taken over as treasurer, which now meant he had access to those funds and to the banks. And my understanding is he transferred money out of community funds into his own account.
And was it a once-off payment, or had there been kind of trickling?
I think it had been trickling. Mm. There might have been one or two significant, but it had been trickling because it amounted to something like 56,000, I think, 53, yeah. 56,000. As tough as it would have been, and it would have been, we'd have been able to manage to pay it back, even if we'd ended up having to sell the house to do it. It would have been done. It was manageable. So up until the 29th, you know, as I say, things were somewhat tense between myself and Sanj. But, you know, it was the summer holidays. I had actually taken parental leave that summer. So I had a five weeks of leave to be with the boys, which was just fantastic.
Yeah. Because Kathleen, you were the primary earner of the family at the time, and Sanjeev, a modern husband and a stay-at-home husband.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that all worked perfectly.
I knew that Sanj, you know, did dabble, in inverted commas, in the stock exchange. He was investing, as he would have said, you know, in trading, stocks and shares. But it was always a sideline.
And that was his background, wasn't it?
Banking, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, that was fine. And I always said, you know, if he made it big, happy days, and I'd give up my job and we'd live happily ever after, you know.
So you've had that difficult conversation with Sanjeev in the kitchen, maybe even at the kitchen table over the cup of tea. Yeah. How do we fix this? Yeah. And then 10 days later, as we mentioned, Sanjeev brings the boys out for a day of bowling. And they don't come home.
Yeah. And that, you know, I look back in hindsight now and I see that for the week before, there was a calmness about him. At the time, I would have said it was because everything was now out in the open. I hadn't kicked him out of the family home and we were dealing with things. So I saw that calmness as actually a relief that, you know, things were going to be okay in him.
And was he loving with you? And
I didn't want that. So, I had spoken to Owen and I'd asked him, was there any questions? Was he okay? Was there anything he wanted to ask me? And he was okay. He knew Daddy had done something very wrong. But that we were going to sort it out. And that would have only been one or two days before before that Sunday. So, you know, I wasn't pushing it. We were going to, let's do this slowly and gently. He was only 10.
And, you know, it's that motherly and indeed fatherly protection of the child that, you know, we will tell them when they definitely need to know.
Yeah.
But for now, let's allow them to go for a day of bowling with Daddy.
Yeah.
And that's what it should have been.
That's all it should have been. And even the fact that he was taking them and I was staying behind wasn't unusual. It wasn't anything out of the ordinary. If I had known or had any suspicion of what was going to happen, it wouldn't have happened. You know, they wouldn't have been allowed to go, or I wouldn't have let them go. So he'd left on that Sunday night, and it got quite late in the evening, and you know, because it was the holidays, you're not. It could be that they got cut up, or were talking to somebody, or went to McDonald's, or there's all sorts of reasons. But got to about 10 o'clock, and I was getting anxious. Discovered then that he'd left his phone by the bed, so he didn't have a phone with him when I went to try and call him. And you start to think, okay, what's gone on? And I suppose in my head, I thought he'd simply had almost like a breakdown and had just was going, you know, was running with the boys, if you like. And initially I thought he might have gone up to his brother who lived up in Northern Ireland. Then I thought maybe, actually the most prevalent thought for me all that night was that he was gone to the UK. We had only been over, we'd driven over, gone over on the ferry about 3 weeks previously to his mum in London. And I thought, the timing of that seemed right. You know, there was a ferry at about 9 o'clock. He'd left the house at about six, so to get down to Rosslare, get down there in time, etc. And I figured he was probably going to be able to travel on his driving license, and you know, all of those sort of thoughts, because he'd left. I knew the passports were there, were at home, but you know, all that night I thought that's probably what he's done. The worst I thought was that they would be scared. That was the absolute worst. And I remember, you know, Sanjay's brother phoned when I'd spoken to him. He, and in fairness to him, because I phoned him about 1 o'clock in the morning, and he came straight down. And I remember saying, yeah, please do, because I knew that, well, in my head, I knew that when the boys came back with Sanjay, you know, the guards were going to now be involved, the boys would be terrified, and Sanjay's going to need somebody on his side. Even then, that was my concern, that, you know, as much as I was angry with him and I was not going to want him back in the house at that point, I also was concerned for him, you know, because in a way I saw this as a breakdown. Throughout that whole morning, through lunch, you know, people coming and going, the guards coming and going, family and friends, you know, trying to work out where might they be, where could they be. And then I remember at lunchtime, one of the detectives from Kilkenny had to sit down with me to take a statement. And I remember I went about starting, you know, from the night before, and he was like, no, he said, hang on, Kathleen. So you were born in Ballinkillen. And I'm like, oh, okay. So it went right back. So what he was trying to do was paint a picture.
Yeah.
A picture of my relationship with Sanjay, my relationship, I suppose, overall with you know, sort of my place, we'll say. And then my relationship with Sanjay and our family dynamic, and were there other people involved, maybe that sort of thing. And we got about halfway through that. And the phone rang. I had the phone in front of me on the table, and the phone rang. It was just a number. I didn't recognize the number. And I picked it up, and it was Sanjay on the other end of the line. Again, I can't quite remember how the whole conversation went, but it was essentially, you know, are you okay? Are the boys okay? And his answer to that was, no, they're dead in the back. That was how,
Kathleen,
I found out.
I've read those words in your book, but to hear them out of your mouth, it is shocking.
Yeah,
shocking.
And that, I do remember just losing it, dropping the phone. The detective, Sean, who was taking the statement, he had taken the phone from me. He walked out of the sitting room outside at the front door. And these are the things that are actually quite strong in my memory and very clear. So he walked past me. He had to take a call outside. And I have no idea how much time passed. But he came in, and I was able to see the front door from where I was sat. And as he came in the door, there was a sort of a shake of his head and I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. And that's all I know from that. I know I lost it. I know I pretty much collapsed. I think there was a scream. I'm told I did scream. And I remember very vividly that dark hole. And it's the only way I can describe it. And then complete and utter shock kicked in. Because honestly, it's not that you wouldn't have known, but I just remember going into just a place that I could function. And that's the only way I can describe it. I was able to function, and I needed to be able to function, and I wanted to be able to function, and actually to do all of that meant I didn't have to think about anything else. I didn't have to think about the boys. Didn't have to think about the loss. I didn't have to, you know, so just function get through the next breath and the next breath.
You're in survival mode, basically.
Totally.
Kathleen, at this point, are you thinking, you know, you've lost your boys. So that is the end of everything as you know it.
Yeah.
Are you thinking they, you know, lost their lives in a car crash? Or had you been told exactly what had happened? Because what he did...
Yeah, what he did
horrific.
To the boys was horrific. It was a while before I knew that. I was told again very quickly that they were found in the boot of the car. Because I'm not even sure that those around Sanj at that point when he made the phone call to me were aware that the boys were in the car. I think he you know, the focus was on him because obviously he was the only person that was visible in the car. You know, I've heard since that those that were around could see sort of the car seat, the booster seat for the boys and sort of a few bits that they kind of made them suspect there was somebody else in the car. So they wanted to be able to carry out an autopsy as quickly as possible. So, you know, within a few hours, they were talking about the boys needing to be identified. So bless them, my two brothers, Brian and Kevin, immediately stepped up and said that they would go. I think two guards drove them because it was over in Mayo. They were going to have to go to Castlebar. You know, you're talking 3.5-4 hour drive. And I've always been grateful for that because I've always felt that if I had gone over that time myself, because Sanj was in Castlebar Hospital, he did have some injuries. I felt I would have wanted to see him. And I look back on that now and I go, if I had seen him at the time, would I have wanted to be involved? Would I have wanted to support him on some level? Because, you know, this was still the man that I loved. You know, for all that had happened in the couple of weeks previously, or the, you know, I loved him. He was my husband. He was Owen and Rory's father. And so I remember that night, my sister made me go up to bed. So I got into the boys' bed, they into Rory's bed, I suppose, but they had been sleeping in it together for the previous, since the beginning of the year. They shared the bed. And I remember getting in and I remember Irene getting in behind me and just putting her arms around me and I cried and slept. I needed sleep. But I woke up as Kevin and Brian were coming back. I heard the car coming in. I think it was about 3-4 o'clock in the morning. I went down because that was my last little hope that all of this was wrong. That wasn't my boys. Now, logically, I knew, but in my heart, I wanted it to be not them. And I remember, you know, Brian came in and I asked him, was it them? And he said, yeah, it was them. And I remember asking, were they okay? Did they look okay? And he said they did. They looked peaceful. And he told me that they weren't being left alone in the morgue, that there was somebody with them all the time, and that they were leaving the lights on. So that was, you know, that was important to me at the time. Still is. And I suppose that's where I talk about the love that the boys have inspired from then, you know, people who didn't know them were looking out for them and were caring for them. And, you know, that is important as a mom, as a mother. That was so important. I then discovered that legally, Sanj had to be discharged from hospital before he could be arrested. And he also had the right to request an independent autopsy if he wanted. And that couldn't happen until he had been arrested. So there was this back and forth. And there was a very significant risk that I would have had to say goodbye to my boys through a glass window. That they would not have been able to be brought home, or that we wouldn't have been able to have an open coffin. My background is nursing. I know what death does to a body. And I was very aware that the boys needed to come home sooner rather than later. So there was a lot of pressure put on to get them home. And so that they came home to me in the early hours of the Thursday morning.
Were you aware by that stage of the extent of the injuries?
No, okay. No. And I have to say, the first time I realised the extent, I understood that he had suffocated the boys or had strangled them. And that was as much as I knew. So it was when the boys came home that I realised, and even at that stage, the only injury that I could see physically was that there was a fist-sized lump of hair pulled out of Owen's scalp. So it literally had a bald patch, to the extent that they couldn't sleep in on their own sides of the bed, because I had to try and hide that injury, if you like, or that bald patch. So
Owen had beautiful long hair as well.
So it was obvious. It was very obvious. And that was the first time that I really realised that the extent of maybe the violence that had happened. The injuries that Owen had, so his skull effectively had to be pieced back together again, like a jigsaw. So he had extensive sort of head injuries. He had a broken collarbone, ribs, and hip. So hip fracture. So the level of violence that it would have taken in the confines of a car, the backseat of a car, to inflict that is beyond me. Sand, by all accounts, has denied those injuries as being caused by him. I think in court he did say that, you know, it, or certainly when he was interviewed, I should say, by the guards, you know, that they must have been caused by the crash. No, I mean they weren't. They were not caused by the crash. We know that, and we know that from the autopsy. There's no question. And so that he could have inflicted that level of injury on Owen and then strangled him. Again, I thought he'd strangled him manually with his hands. It wasn't. It was a ligature. So he had a rope that he used. And my understanding, and bearing in mind that the only person that knows what happened is Sanj. So, you know, anything that he has said is possibly to his own best interest. But what he did tell the guards was that Rory slept throughout all of that. There's no way, absolutely no way that that could have happened, in my view. And that...
Because that sounds so unbelievably violent.
Yeah. So Owen or Rory has to have witnessed it.
Yeah.
He has to have. Sanj said that he had taken him onto his knee after that to comfort him. And then he strangled him. And bizarrely, I'm grateful for the fact that, you know, he just strangled him. That sounds so strange to say those words, but, you know, after the level of violence against Owen.
Is there evidence that Owen had fought back?
There was some.
Yeah.
There was. So my sense of it is that he was asleep at the time when this started. Sanj, as I understand it, had tried to strangle the three of them together. So he had some convoluted way of these ropes around that he'd pull them, and that all three of them would effectively die together. So what I assume happened, and it is an assumption because, as I say, the only person that can actually tell is Sanj. I assume that Owen woke up as part of that, started fighting. You know, in the midst of just, he's still half asleep, and he's got this person that he trusts most in the world. This monster, as I see him now, looming over, that's how I envisage it, looming over him, and causing this hurt. All I can pray for and hope for is that the injuries were such that, the head injury was such that he lost consciousness quickly. That's all I can hope.
You got to bring the boys home. You had 24 hours with your boys.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll be forever grateful for that. You know, they were in their own room. They were in the same bed, albeit on opposite sides, but they were in bed together. And
as you say, like they would be.
They would be. And I was so proud to have people come and see them. It's so strange. And I've spoken to another mum who lost a little girl and would have said similar. I remember when I went to that wake, you know, seeing a certain proudness in showing off her little girl. And I felt exactly the same with Owen and Rory. You know, I wanted people to see them, to know them. And so I was, it was such a strange and surreal time. You know, there were kids in and out of the room.
And you've been in mummy mode, changing fresh sheets.
Oh, total.
Getting the beds ready.
Yeah.
Boys in their
fresh jerseys, their Kilkenny jerseys, their Kilkenny outfits. And, you know, absolutely. And you wanted the room just right. And you wanted all the things that were important to them there. And, you know, and they were. And, you know, I've always said that the boys were at peace, even with what they've gone through. They were at peace because I don't believe that children in particular would have been as comfortable going in and out of the room as they were if the boys had not been at peace. So while what happened to them was absolutely horrendous, that sense of them and that sense of peace was... And I needed that. I needed that comfort, if you like. You know, so there was lots of presents put on the bed for them. There was toothbrushes because they were going to need to brush their teeth in heaven. There were sweets galore. I would have talked to my family members about the fact that I feel very strongly that they forgave Sanj. I won't ever forgive him.
He's serving a life sentence, which in Ireland, we know, does not necessarily mean life behind bars, Kathleen.
Yeah.
He's been up for parole already, right?
Yeah, which totally took me by surprise, to be honest. When he pled guilty in the first place, my fear was that there would be an insanity plea of some sort, or diminished responsibility or something. But he didn't. He pled guilty from the start. And, you know, that did make things a little bit easier for me. But it also made it easier for him. You know, we knew he had done this. So he was always guilty. But by pleading guilty, it meant there was no real case. It was really just a sentencing hearing. Which meant he didn't have to confront anything that he had done. So I thought that when it would come to parole, that he wouldn't apply, that he would just let it go. And at 7 years, the new Parole Act had just come into law, been signed into law, and I wasn't aware that it then needed to be commenced, if you like, and that hadn't happened. So in my head, he couldn't apply for parole. You know, it took a bit of time for me to calm down and take the deep breath and, you know, kind of go, okay, what do I do now and what do I do with this? And I suppose the one piece I think in the book that actually is quoted in the book is my submission to the parole board. That's when I discovered that the parole bill was in law, it hadn't been enacted and therefore it wasn't being acted upon. So then I started sort of making the phone calls and finding out a little bit more about that. But in the meantime, I then had to make my own submission to the parole board. And I just went, you know, why am I having to make this was pretty much my argument. Is it not obvious why he should never receive parole, let alone after 7 years?
Because this is a man who not only strangled your two little boys, but you subsequently found out in an email that he was, in actual fact, planning to kill you as well.
Yeah. So about 6 weeks after the boys were killed, I was going through emails. I was going through Owen's email account, as it happens. Our laptop and computer had been taken away by the guards. So I had no access to photographs of the boys. And I knew there would be some photos on this because it had been created when Owen was born so that, you know, Sanj could send photos to his mum and dad, you know, from Owen, effectively. And so I was going through it and I was going through some of the, you know, so you start going through all the folders then just because I was randomly just sort of going through it. And the next thing I see this email that Sanj had written. In it, it was basically a suicide note. He'd waffled on a little bit about trading and how to trade with stocks and shares, which was bizarre. But then from the middle onwards was something along the lines of raise a glass to Kathleen and the boys and forget about me, you know, but remember them. And I was like, oh, he intended taking all of us. And this was dated a year and a half earlier. So that shook me completely to the core because I went, I've lain next to this man every night and he's wanted to kill me. You know, and it wasn't one of those, I could kill her. It was, no, actually, in his mind, he has planned how he will kill me and our two sons and then himself. So a whole family annihilation was what he thought about and planned. A friend of his subsequently who was in touch with him and bless him, he had contacted me in advance to know, was it okay to you know, to see Sanj or to be in communication with him. And I was like, yes, it is, because I thought maybe I'll learn something. So Gary was going off to see him and asked, it, was there anything I wanted to know or ask? And the two questions were, am I in danger from any, you know, in other words, had he gotten loans from loan sharks or something like that? So am I in danger? And why didn't he take me? So the first and the answer to the first question was no, I wasn't. And to the second was he knew that I would have fought back and he probably wouldn't have been able to do it. So so we add cowardly to the list of expletives that I would use in relation to him. And you know, because, and it's not that I'm wishing that he had taken me. There have been many times where I have wished that, but it's not that I necessarily feel, you know, that way about it. But it is, you know, now I look at it and I go, you know, am I in danger in the future? You know, if he gets out on parole, which he will do. I talk about this being a fight, and I will fight every single time his application comes through. I am, at the moment, I'm strong enough and I am, you know, worked up enough to fight. And I will fight at 12 years and I'll fight again at 13, 14, 15, 16, whatever number of years are there. But what happens at 18, 19, 20 years when I mightn't feel up to the fight and he does get parole? That's my biggest fear. He doesn't deserve to leave prison, in my view. I just don't think he deserves it. And yet I know that this is a fight I will lose, because the life sentence, the average life sentence in this country is 20 years. To me, he deserves nothing. What he did and the betrayal of Owen and Rory, and how he did it, to my mind, means he deserves nothing.
And And my thanks to Kathleen Chadha for joining me today. Everything is published by Umbrella Publishing and is available in all good bookshops. I'm Siobhan Maguire, and today's episode was produced by myself, researched by Tabitha Monaghan and Anna Vejlarczyk, with sound by John Smith. If you enjoy the Indo Daily, don't forget to like, follow and leave us a review.